Welcome to SCOTUSCast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Thank you for joining us for this post-decision episode of SCOTUSCast. I'm your host, Grace Gotchling. On May 7, 2020, the Supreme Court released its decision in United States v. Sinning Smith. At issue is whether the federal criminal prohibition against encouraging or inducing illegal immigration for commercial advantage or private financial gain is facially unconstitutional. By a vote of 9-0, the judgment of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit was vacated and the case remanded. Although every member of the court joined Justice Ginsburg's opinion, Justice Thomas also issued a concurring opinion indicating his doubt about the validity of the overbreadth doctrine. And now, to discuss the case, we have Brian Fish, Special Assistant United States Attorney of Baltimore, Maryland.
Well, thank you very much. Greetings from the bunker location here in East Baltimore. Again, my name is Brian Fish. I am the Baltimore Lawyers Chapter President and an attorney here in the city and on the Society's Criminal Law Practice Group Executive Committee. Today, I have the pleasure of talking for a few minutes about, as we say in the business, a crimmigration case, United States versus Sinning Smith. I have no idea if I'm pronouncing that correctly, and hopefully I won't say that the rest of the day. This case was argued relatively recently, back on February 25th, so about 2.5 months later, we get today's decision. Before I get too into the heart of the case, I got to say, it's easy for pundits like myself to pick on the Ninth Circuit. And this is one of those cases where, why not? It's just so darned easy. This case comes at us today, this morning, having just been released literally blocks away from where I'm sitting from Johns Hopkins Hospital. Justice Ginsburg gives us a 9-0 decision, essentially slapping down yet again the Ninth Circuit. And as a pundit, you have to wonder, do these guys just sit around out there in California and say, hey, I've got a new idea, a grand, great new idea on how we can get reversed? Because no one's ever thought of this particular way to get reversed by the Supreme Court. And the other judges on the panel say, I love it. That's a great idea. Let's run with it. Because that had to be what the Ninth Circuit was thinking in this case. Otherwise, there's just no other explanation for it. And again, this was a 9-0 decision that comes at us today. And it sort of leads up to the, this is a WTF moment. This has got to be what the judges were thinking after they heard the oral arguments in this case. And they're like, what is going on out there? Why would the Ninth Circuit possibly create a case where, and that's what they did. They created a case in both the trial court level and at the initial Court of Appeals hearing, counsel for the defendant, thank God I remember to say the defendant and not her name, had a standard issue argument, no must, no harm, no foul, a run-of-the-mill case. After oral arguments, but before decision was made, the Ninth Circuit created a new case, ruled upon that newly created case, and that's what was appealed by the government to the Supreme Court. And that case is what got reversed. It got sent back to the Ninth and presumably back to the trial court for a decision on what actually took place. But that's probably for another day. So, again, this is a new way to get reversed. So let's get into the heart of the case. here's the takeaway line from the syllabus, and Judge Justice Ginsburg uses it in her decision. But the Ninth Circuit's radical transformation of this case goes well beyond the pale. And she says that in her analysis of this is an abuse of discretion. So we have right off the bat a language that every good Irishman wants to hear. This is beyond the pale. And when the court uses such language, you know it's going to be a bad day for the court that's this case came from, and that's what happened. A little bit of factual background. So those of you on the call, if you remember, I did the courthouse steps back in February when this case was argued. So I'll cut to the facts we need to talk about today. First of all, the defendant was a lawyer who was operating an immigration consulting firm out in San Jose. Most of her clients are Filipinos here in the United States illegally. The key part of the criminal prosecution was that between 2001 and 2008, the defendant was charging $5,900 a pop for the following. She would file what's called a labor certificate with the United States Department of Labor. What is supposed to happen is the Labor Department certifies that piece of paper that alien has a job that no one else wanted and should therefore continue in the process to eventually become a green card holder, as they say, a lawful permanent resident. And it starts with the labor certificate. But notice the years I've said, 2001 to 2008. One of the magical dates in immigration law is April 30th, 2001. That's when the program ended. You had to have had your certificate filed by that date. To this day, they are still adjudicating both through United States Citizenship and Immigration Services, the Department of Labor, and the immigration court system. They're still adjudicating the cases that started on or before April 30th, 2001. But what this woman was doing was she was generating these cases and taking the money from her clients after the cutoff date. So in other words, there was absolutely no possible way for this alien to adjust their status based on an approved labor certificate if the case was filed after April 30th, 2001. To the tune of, this woman made $3.3 million in fees generated by doing something that could not have possibly generated for her client relief from removal. In other words, the green card. That was the factual foundation for a multi-count case, which went to a 12-day trial. The defendant was convicted of multiple counts, had a motion for judgment of acquittal, actually got two of the counts dismissed, and after trial was therefore guilty of four counts, two immigration statute cases under 1324, and a couple of wire fraud kind of crimes. That case was appealed. Again, oral arguments were held, and after oral arguments, the Ninth Circuit then decided on their own to ask three different defendant right kinds of organizations for amicus briefs, and they asked three separate questions of these organizations. Was the statute 1324 overbroad? Was it vague? And did the statute require a mens rea element that was not in this particular case? The defendant did not make this argument. And in a sense, this particular argument that the Court of Appeals generated on their own was contra to what the defendant was arguing in her, both at the trial court and in the oral arguments before the court. But again, the Ninth Circuit made up a new case and asked organizations not involved in the case for their opinion. That's essentially what Justice Ginsburg was talking about when she said that was a complete and utter abuse of discretion. And what the language and the idea is that any court, is supposed to adjudicate the case presented to them and not simply create a new case to be argued. But again, that's what the Ninth Circuit said, and that's what they did, and that's what they ruled upon. So that's the case that we have before us today. And there was much discussion of the statute itself during the whole process from the district court through the Court of Appeals and through oral arguments. Was 1324 overly broad? And this will, I'll talk about Justice Thomas's concurring opinion in depth in a minute or two, but the heart of the matter is which is, and this is just Justice Thomas's idea and his reason for concurring, and is that the court's idea of whether a statute is overly broad is in and of itself unconstitutional. Which Thomas is essentially saying is when a statute is analyzed by a court, they should be looking at what is a particular defendant's First Amendment rights being violated, and not being thinking, well, someone in the future could be cooled, as they say, from making certain First Amendment speech pronouncements because they might be prosecuted for a violation, in this case, of Section 1324. That, in Thomas's opinion, is an unconstitutional application of jurisprudence by a court on a particular statute. We should be looking at directly at one particular defendant and was their speech protected by the First Amendment, yes or no? And that's the reason for his rather lengthy concurring opinion. He essentially starts by saying, I agree with everything Justice Ginsburg said on the fact that the Ninth Circuit created a new case and we can send it back for that reason. But here's something else I want to talk about. And during oral arguments, we have a lot of discussion about grandmothers. And that was the moniker that several justices were using when they were deciding, trying to figure out, is 1324 overly broad? And they were asking, but if a United States citizen grandmother wanted their undocumented grandson to be able to stay in the United States, would an application of 1324 on the grandmother, would it apply? Would it chill the grandmother's speech by telling her grandson, no, you should stay? And so therefore, that picks up what exactly does 1324 prohibit? And 1324, again, Title 8 of the United States Code, Section 1324, is a prohibition on – hold on, let me get to the right language. I apologize. Let's see here. All right, here we go. What 1324 prohibits is the inducement, essentially, by one individual of another to stay in, either come to, enter, or stay in the United States, in knowingly in violation of the law. So, in other words, if you here in the United States are telling someone, asking someone to come into the United States, or giving them reason or cause to stay in the United States, knowing that their presence here in the United States is against the law, that then you have violated Section 1324. And the grandmother analogy comes into play with, look, or really would grandmama really be in violation of section 1324 because she's inducing the language of the statute her grandson to stay in the United States when he is in fact here illegally. 1324 goes on for there was much discussion at oral arguments whether this was a sentence enhancement idea or whether it was a new crime, essentially. But the court, in its opinion, sort of discounted that entire argument. But for our purposes, we need to know that it is a sentence enhancement. In other words, it doubles the potential jail sentence and fine if you are doing the enticing of the alien for financial gain, which obviously is what the defendant in this case was doing, again, to the tune of $3.3 million. She was enticing people to stay in violation of the law, knowing that they would continue to be in violation of the law because there was no way that they could adjust their status through a program which had ended. But if you're going to be a fraudster, I guess do it to the tune of $3.3 million. So the Justice Ginsburg, in her decision, stressed again that this was an abuse of discretion, in rather harsh language in the body of her opinion. Again, she uses the beyond the pale moniker, calls out the Ninth Circuit panel for adjudicating a case not before them, and takes them to task for doing it. Justice Thomas, in his concurring opinion, again, as I said a moment ago, agreed with majority that says that the overbreadth doctrine, but goes on to say, that the court's doctrine of a statutory interpretation being overly broad, he has constitutional issues with that. And he starts his concurring opinion with an analysis that the overbreadth doctrine really doesn't come into play until 1940 with a case out of Alabama. And so therefore, he finds that the overbreadth doctrine is not based on any constitutionally valid statutory interpretation methods, and discounts the whole process, the whole notion that a statute can be overly broad. His argument essentially is the following, that the court should have, in any of these kinds of cases where the notion that a statute is overly broad, the court should look at whether a particular defendant's conduct was protected by the First Amendment. If it's not, then whether the statute as it's written sweeps in other activities such as freedom of the press, et cetera. In particular cases that Justice Thomas cites in his opinion, what he wants to look at is not whether a generalized First Amendment cooling is implicated, if you will, by a particular statute, but again, focus on each individual defendant. He really takes the task, the court in general, for its overbreadth doctrine, because what he's saying is the court is applying a future, this idea that in the future, someone's actions or statements might be chilled by thinking, oh God, if I say this, will someone prosecute me? He discounts that entire line of cases, that entire theory, and wants us to focus back on an individual. If they made a statement, was that statement protected by the First Amendment? And here in this particular case, Thomas would argue that no, this defendant's statement of essentially give me money and I will help you get a green card, and her pronouncement through advertising and then to individual clients that she can help them get a green card, is not protected by the First Amendment because, first of all, she couldn't. It was a fraud scheme. She could not in any way whatsoever after April 30th, 2001, through this program, help anybody get a green card because the program was over. So that's how he would want us to look at these kinds of cases. And while he would agree with the majority in their opinion that the Ninth Circuit basically created a new case and decided that case, he wants us to go beyond that and actually wipe out the entire line of overbreadth cases. And again, just look at individual defendants and what they did and what they said. So this case is going back, as I said, going back to the Ninth Circuit. They've already had arguments on the defendant's initial theory of the case and why her conviction should be thrown out. Presumably, but who knows, but presumably at this point, the Ninth Circuit will now affirm the conviction, and that's the end of the case. But it remains to be seen what exactly happens.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.